Good morning. It's February 18th. I will call the House Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee to order. Thank you all for being here this morning. And before we get going, I wanted to acknowledge, I haven't done this in the last couple of meetings, but we do have two wonderful committee pages. One is Ping over here, and the other is Eric. Oh, you're also over there now. Thank you for servicing our committee. And the first order of business, of course, is the approval of the minutes from February 13th. Representative Duran, would you like to move the minutes?
Yep, we reviewed them. Everything looks good.
Perfect. Any discussion on the approval of the minutes from? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The minutes are approved. First order of business today is House File 7. Welcome, Representative Novotny, Chair Novotny. And I will move the bill before the committee and recommend that it be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy. And we have the bill before us. Please talk about your bill, Representative Botney.
Thank you, Chair Scott. House File 7 represents the priorities of the House Republican Caucus in the public safety area. The bill's themes are helping law enforcement make our communities safer from criminals, keeping violent and dangerous offenders off the street, holding the criminal justice system accountable. There are 12 different provisions that compromise this bill. They come from bills that Republicans have authored. Many of them have been introduced in the previous biennium, but the House DFL majority has not given them a hearing. Some of the bills have been requested by law enforcement, and they have put these provisions in the bill. Other sections have been in response to heart-wrenching stories. We continue to hear of violent criminals who are out in the street reoffending. Finally, there are some provisions of the bill that have come from the frustration the public has when it comes to charging and sentencing practices of the criminal justice agencies. There have been a dramatic increase in carjackings and stolen vehicles in the past 5 years. Many of these crimes are committed by juveniles, some as young as 12 years old, and we just saw a week ago 10 and 11-year-olds. They use these stolen cars to commit more crimes, often baiting police into chasing them, knowing they won't be prosecuted. There are provisions of this bill that has requested to get a better handle on these crimes. They include an increased penalty for fleeing police in a reckless manner, excessively speeding, running red lights and stoplights, thereby putting the public at a greater risk of serious injury or loss of life. Making it a crime to be in a stolen vehicle. Under current law, police can only arrest the driver, but they know that everyone in the car is aware the car was stolen, and the passengers are usually placed in an active role of stealing it to start with. Authorizing law enforcement to place tracking devices on fleeing vehicles. The law was changed 2 years ago to allow law enforcement to put tracking devices on a vehicle that was reported stolen. That law needs to be amended to allow the placement of the tracking device on a vehicle when it is occupied as well. And we do have an amendment that I will speak about later in regards to that. There are other public safety concerns the law enforcement and the public have expressed to us in the past few years. This bill seeks to address these concerns. It increases the penalty for blocking a freeway, a highway, transit, or a road to or from an airport. These are dangerous practices for not only the people involved in the protest, but the people using these public accesses and for emergency vehicles that may not be able to get to a fire or a hospital with a person who is in a life-threatening situation. It increases the penalty on people who conspire to trespass or damage critical infrastructure such as pipelines, utility lines, and substations, as well as water and sewer lines. And today, on the anniversary of the death of three public safety officers, I'd just like to point out that public safety has been under assault, both figuratively as well as literally in recent years. It is one of the reasons peace officers have been leaving the profession. This bill includes a penalty increase for assaulting a peace officer to a felony level. It has a predatory offender registration requiring offenders who engage in criminal sexual conduct and receive state sentences. And then we will also talk about possible modifications to that in the bill as we get to the meat of that. Finally, this bill brings sunlight to the practices of our criminal justice partners, many of whom work hard every day to keep our community safe, but some of whom have a revolving door that spins criminals back out on the street. This bill requires greater public disclosure of who pays bills or who pays the bail to get someone out of jail. A publicly searchable database for county attorney case dismissals, a publicly searchable database for criminal sentencing reductions, and legislative approval for sentencing charges promulgated by the governor-appointed unelected sentencing guideline commission. The provisions of this bill are not the only solutions House Republicans have, but they represent a cross-section of bills that will make our community safer. And as I said, Chair Scott, I do have two amendments.
Thank you, Chair Novotny. And I just want to make sure that the committee understands that we will be taking a hard vote on this at a hard stop at 11:30 because we do have presenters here from the Cannabis Expungement Board. So we will be discussing this. It should be ample time to discuss this bill. And with that, Representative Novotny, which amendment would you like to take up first?
Let's start with A7.
Go ahead with the A7. What does the A7 do?
In response to testimony and questions from members of the House when we presented this bill to public safety, on page 8, line 9, there was concern about whether a victim would be exposed if their information on whether they supported the dismissal or not would be exposing them to judgment. So in response to the request from, I believe it was Representative Berg, we have struck that part of the provision, and we will honor the anonymity of the decision that the victim has made. That is A7.
Okay, I will move the A7 before us. Discussion on the A7. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Novotny, and I appreciate the effort to remove the victim from this, but it still doesn't solve the broader problem with this particular portion of the bill and cases being dismissed. So if a victim does support the dismissal, you're not giving any indication of that now, which is good for the victim. It also suggests the prosecutor is dismissing a case even though a victim may not be available to testify. So I don't think it solves the problem. I appreciate the effort to do that. I will vote for it just because it's an author's amendment, and I think we should support author's amendment, but just wanted to make that point. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Mueller. In response to that, Chair Novotny.
Chair Mueller, if there's language that you would suggest that we use or would help make the bill better, I'm always willing to sit down with you on that.
Thank you. With that, members, all those in favor of moving the A7, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A7 is adopted. The next amendment before us is the A6. Representative Novotny.
The A6 amendment is regards to the use of the tracking devices on stolen vehicles. There was concern about the language, and this will be on page 1. First of all, we worked with Chair Scott, members of the Ramsey County Sheriff's Office, who were the requesters of the bill and the main users of this technology. And one of the things that we talked about in public safety last week that was expressed was clarification that the vehicles could not have the tracker place them if they were in your yard or on private property. After consulting with the Ramsey County Sheriff's Office members, they did say that that is something that we could strike and make clarification so everyone is understanding that we are not seeking a search warrant, an unauthorized search. This is so the stolen vehicle would only be able to have the device placed on it if it is unoccupied, if it is not on public property or private property, so in a right-of-way. The other things in discussion with the law as it stands, it currently allows if the vehicle is placed on a stolen vehicle that was occupied in compliance with the current law, they had 24 hours before they had to remove the vehicle or get a search warrant. In review of the use of the vehicle, we've been told that 12 hours is more than enough. And so this amendment does strike the 24 and replaces it with 12 hours. And finally, starting on line 119, language that states when a peace officer attaches this device to a stolen vehicle pursuant to paragraph A2, they must provide a report on the why it was used, the time and date the device was attached, the method that was used to attach the device, because as we know, some of them can be placed manually on the vehicle and some can be launched from a short distance to discreetly put the vehicle as being monitored. The duration which the tracking device was attached to the vehicle, an explanation of how the device impacted the outcome of the investigation. And those reports would be placed in the criminal investigation file. So we feel that these have addressed several of the concerns that I know you, Chair Scott, had, and some of our data privacy citizens that were involved in working with the Sheriff's Office. As they said, we believe that this amendment addresses those sufficiently.
Thank you, Representative Botney. And I will move the A6. The A6 is before us. And discussion, Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you so much, Chair Novotny, for this amendment. It addresses one of the concerns that I raised at the public safety hearing around the fact that this could result in warrantless searches at people's private property. I still have concerns. I didn't love the bill that we passed last term. I really struggle with warrantless searches in general, but I do think this goes a long way to avoiding the abuse that I was very concerned about. So I still have concerns, but this goes a long way towards addressing them. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Feist. Further discussion? All right, the A6 is before us. All those in favor of adopting the A6, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A6 is adopted. The House File 7, as amended, is before us. Further discussion by members. Well, excuse me. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I'll just start with the tracking, since we just had that amendment. And I'm looking at line 14.11 to 14.13. And just so people understand what this bill is doing, I was actually the author of the tracking bill a couple of years ago, and we worked really carefully. I brought this bill on behalf of the Ramsey County Sheriff's Office, worked really carefully with them to craft language in that bill. And we had a number of things, protections that we added in, including the length of time, which I know we just changed with the amendment, and also some reporting requirements. If you look at lines 13.20, beginning there, there's some of the other requirements. And it's my understanding there's two different desires to amend the language that we passed a couple years ago. One is the sheriffs want to be able to use the tracker on all stolen cars, whether they're occupied or not. And then the chiefs have a separate proposal, and they want to use it on all fleeing cars, not just fleeing cars that are stolen. So those are like two different things that are happening in this bill. And the amendment we just adopted relates to the stolen cars. But when you're looking at lines 14.11 to 14.13, that's the fleeing cars, and that has none of the other protections that we put in there, namely the one about how long the tracker can stay on the car and also the reporting that's required. So I'm a little curious why this 14.11 to 13 is just a blanket exception, and none of those other guardrails were included.
Chair Novotny.
Well, a couple things. Anytime the device, the amendment, from my reading and our intent, was that anytime the device is deployed, that there would need to be a report filed. Under the current law, the way I read it, a report would only need to be filed if there was a search warrant applied for and granted after the time period was up to enable the agencies to continue to use the tracking data. So this amendment that I have is that anytime the device is deployed. And I do have testifiers that we're going to speak to this if you have questions. Members of the Sheriff Fletcher and Undersheriff Mike Martin are here if you have questions.
We're similar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I think that will be helpful. I think the provision, though, here is what the chiefs wanted, and I guess I just want to make sure that those guardrails with the timing of how long the tracker can be placed on and the reporting would also be included if we were going to pass something that said all fleeing cars could get these devices. I just want to make sure those guardrails are still in place. The way I read this language, they're not. And so, you know, I'm happy to discuss that or work on that further.
Representative Novotny, I'm sorry. Thank you, Representative Mueller. Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Scott. Yes, that intent and discussion I had with the users of these devices, that at any time the device is used, whether it's stolen or not, that it would apply to that. Addressing Representative Feist's question, and it kind of ties into your question also, the expectation of privacy in a stolen vehicle has been established many times as there isn't an expectation of privacy. And as I spoke last week, a fleeing vehicle is subject to forfeiture. If it's subject to forfeiture because the person that's driving the vehicle is the owner or has permission to use the vehicle, you wouldn't need a warrant to seize that vehicle. If it's a stolen vehicle, there's not an expectation of privacy in a stolen vehicle. So I don't understand why we keep going back to that. Maybe it's just just have to agree to disagree, or maybe the courts will be involved in that. But if we need to clean up the language that specifically addresses Representative Mueller's concerns, I'm more than willing to do that.
Chair Novotny, let's hear from the testifiers. I think the first one is Mike Martin. Mr. Martin, if you want to come up to the table.
Well, Mike can come too.
Sure, Sheriff Fletcher, go ahead. Have a seat, and we'll hear from both of you.
Where would you like me?
Right. Wherever you need, sir. You sit.
No. Well, first of all, thank you for your service on this committee.
Please introduce yourself for the tape.
Sure. I'm Bob Fletcher, Ramsey County Sheriff, and I want to thank you for serving. I think we all agree that public safety is one of the biggest issues facing our community. We all want to get there. It's just a matter of how and the different tactics, but I think there's a lot of commonality here. And I appreciate that. I've worked across both sides of the aisle over 40 years, and that's the only way we really get anything done. So regarding this issue, the sheriff's office is just here to ask for the right to put a tracker on a stolen vehicle. Representative Mueller is correct. There are some in the audience here, Jeff Potts chief among them, that would like to tag other vehicles as well that are fleeing. I don't really think this language that you referred to authorizes the tagging of a fleeing vehicle. That's my read of it. I'm not 100% certain what it does, but I don't think it authorizes or takes that next step that you're concerned about, Representative Mueller. It could, I mean, obviously, but our goal here is to reduce crime. And the best way to reduce crime, I hate to say it, is actually arresting the career criminals that are committing crime on a daily basis. There's a small group. In the 80s, we worked on burglars. We reduced it by 25%. In the 90s, we worked on gang members. in the 2000s on domestic assault. If you focus our attention on the career criminals that are really committing the crime, you can actually reduce crime. And we've reduced, I think John Choi's in the audience here, we've partnered up with John Choi, and we've reduced our auto thefts by 75% on our side of the river, and we've reduced carjackings by 90%. And actually arresting the offenders is a key part of that. Now, I don't want you to think that we're, you know, foolish enough to think that arresting is the end. What we've done is we have navigators working with the families through money supplied by the Auto Theft Commerce Grant that work with the kids and the families and have made a huge difference. So arrest is the beginning of helping children get the help they need on their addiction, their peers, et cetera. So the only way we can really arrest them is to catch them in their stolen cars. Let's just face it, unless you catch a person in a car, we're not going to get them charged. It's just the reality of how the justice system works. And so we will see a stolen car in front of a known auto theft's house, thief's house, and we like to tag it. We like to put a little tracker on it. So what we do quickly is we call the owner if we can find the owner's phone number. If we can find the report that was made in a different jurisdiction, and we get the owner's permission where we can. And in about half of the cases, in a timely way, we get the owner to say, yes, you can track my car. So we install a small tracker, small little device. I have one here if you're interested in seeing one later. If we can't get a hold of the owner, then we're subject to, we just sit on the car and watch it. Or do we call the helicopter, which is one of our amazing tools we have, the helicopter. But the helicopter really doesn't want to watch a car sitting. They want to watch moving cars. Once it moves, the helicopter is the best tracking device we have. It really is another tracking device. Sometimes we'll call the manufacturer and see if the car has tracking. A lot of you that have bought new cars in the last 5 years know that you can get, you know, Accu, whatever it's called. My wife has it on her car, where you can actually track your own car. Someone can track it. But when I was having this conversation with Representative Mueller, who we've known each other for many years, and I understand the individual rights and the desire to catch bad guys. We like the tracker because it allows us to pick and choose a safe spot to actually stop the car. Because if we just sit on the car and we wait for them to leave and we turn our red lights on, guess what? We're into the fleeing. And we don't like fleeing situations. Because once you have a fleeing situation, everybody's at danger. The people in the squad car, the kids that are in the stolen, ages 11 through 17, we want to be able to pick and choose our spots to do a vehicle intervention technique, a VIT. Not a PIT, but and we use unmarked cars. Our whole team has unmarked cars, probably a dozen of them, that are able to block these cars in at a red light where they might not know we're there. And so think of this tracking tool as not just a chance to violate someone's rights. This is a safety tool to stop high-speed chases. And we have had hundreds of success stories using this tactic when we get permission to put it on. So our goal is within the 12 hours that Representative Chair Scott authored, within 12 hours to be able to get a hold of the owner, to get the owner's permission. If we don't get a hold of the owner in 12 hours, then we would remove the tracker. But that gives us a window. You know, and our CAT team works from 7 in the morning until 2 a.m. the next morning. So there's a window there for us to get the owner's contact and install it. So does that help a little bit, Kelly?
Representative Mueller, do you want to respond to that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've never had a testifier ask me to yield for a question before, but yeah, Sheriff, it does help, but I still think there are people who are going to have some concerns about doing that.
Just yeah, I appreciate that. If I can, Madam Chair,
sure.
Just so you know, even though Jeff Potts, Executive Director of the Chiefs, is here, Mike and I, we are not here to testify in support of their desire, all right? That might be a good idea, but I've been around this place long enough to know that good ideas take about 10 years, actually, to be vetted through the legislature. We're only here to testify to put a tracker, not on private property, on a stolen car for a 12-hour period until we can get a hold of the owner and get permission. And 99.9% of the owners have told us, yes, you can track my car. I'd like to catch the person that stole my car. And it reduces chases, which is our big thing.
Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a comment and a question. I'm so glad you raised the really great work that Ramsey County and John Choi's office does around youth restorative justice. John Choi's office is the only one that did a PowerPoint for me. So there are 17 counties around the state that do really good work like this, like Pine County, Yellow Medicine County, Hennepin County. But I understand yours the best because of the PowerPoint. So it's just like really great to hear those numbers, how impactful it is. Because we, like you said, like we know that these kids aren't bad kids, like they're struggling, and to like efficiently, effectively intervene is so important when they come into contact with law enforcement. So I'm glad you mentioned that. And then I just have a really practical question. You said that this is really impactful when you get permission, and I was just wondering if you could talk about what is the process for getting permission, getting a warrant to use these tracking devices.
Sure.
Sheriff Fletcher.
Madam Chair. Well, there's two different types of permission. Of course, the owner is the one we go to, and the statute as it is allows us to put a tracker on the owner's own car. I mean, they can certainly do that themselves, but they essentially delegate that to us. The process, some cities are starting to put that in their auto theft report. When you take an auto theft report, do you consent to allowing law enforcement to track your car? If it's in the report, that's awesome. We're golden. But not a majority have yet. And so we try to contact the owner to get permission. We do, and when we do, like I said, 99% of the time they authorize it. But we only get a hold of them probably 50% of the time, and then we're on to now what do we do for the next 4 hours? Do we sit on it? Do we – basically we lose it if we don't have the ability to track it. Problem is these stolen cars aren't just used for joyriding anymore. They're constantly stealing stuff from construction vans. Lately they've been in burglaries. They've been involved in carjackings in Minneapolis. I mean, if you read the news or look at the Crime Watch stuff, Minneapolis has a constant thread of more crime, and the stolen cars are used to commit the crime. So that's another, we like to take the tool of their trade away. But to your question on permission regarding warrants, if necessary, we do go to a judge and ask permission to have a search warrant to place it on the. We do this with a lot of things. Phones. If we know that a suspect is wanted and we can get a phone tracker for the phone. Phone trackers are terrible, though. They only ping every 10 minutes. So we pretty much, he's in that area. It's a 3,000-meter circle or something. Not really that helpful. But the trackers we install on cars ping every 3 seconds. So we do get judges' warrants. We use warrants to put trackers on vehicles that aren't stolen. Like I said, warrants to put trackers on vehicles that aren't stolen when we have probable cause in the affidavit to suggest that these individuals are involved in a lot of crime. That usually involves gun crime. Sadly, many of the 75, really, on our side of the river, it's a core of 75 kids. It's the same 75 kids doing crime over and over. It's a very small number, and that's why John and I have been trying to get them adequate services, because if you can impact that number, you're doing good. But sadly, many of them have started carrying guns, and we monitor their social media, and they're flashing their guns on social media. The last year, most of them want to flash themselves with switches. This morning here, in the last hour, our gun team with the CAT team did a search warrant up on Westminster and recovered a gun with a switch from one of our primary auto thieves that has decided to graduate into guns and switches. So it's all connected, ultimately. And we don't want to violate. I was a poli-sci major at Hamline. I'm a big fan of constitutional protections. We just want to balance it with being sure that we can actually protect the future victims by arresting current suspects.
Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I just want to get like really granular and practical. So when you need to get a warrant from a judge, let's say it's the most inconvenient time of day. It's like the middle of the night.
Yes.
What does that process look like? How long does it take? How hard is it?
Sheriff Fletcher.
Madam Chair, Representative Feist. Middle of the night, a little troublesome. You know, we do have on-call judges. You know, during the daytime, writing a warrant, getting it signed, getting it back, 2 to 3 hours. You know, at nighttime, could be just a little longer than that. So that's our window of delay, a couple hours.
Representative Feist, you're good.
So, Madam Chair, I was a couple of minutes late to committee today, and I did not hear if you discussed what the jurisdiction of this committee is for this bill. But I must say I feel like I'm in public safety committee here. We're not really discussing the things that are before this committee, and I hope that this committee and, you know, as important as public safety is, we are not the public safety committee, and I hope that we're not going to be spending our time just going over public safety. In fact, I'm kind of even a little surprised to be taking public safety amendments in this committee. I have not served in public safety, and I'm glad some of the members here have and are so that they can raise some questions. But that is kind of my first comment, Madam Chair. I'm also kind of wondering about the fiscal impact of this bill. I don't think we have a fiscal note, and I do think there is going to be some significant fiscal impacts to agencies that we do have jurisdiction over, the courts. We have some letters in our packets bringing up some of these concerns. So I know the bill has been moved to go back to public safety. But, Madam Chair, this question for you, just wondering why you're not just laying it over here so that when the fiscal note comes, we can hear it here and then send it back to public safety.
Thank you, Representative Liebling, for those questions. Number one, I didn't go over the purview but of the bill that applies to this committee, but search warrants and civil liberties directly fall under the jurisdiction of this committee. It has to do with privacy, which is under the jurisdiction of this committee. The bill is going back to public safety, which is the proper place for it to go if there is a fiscal note. This is a public safety bill. So if there's a fiscal note, it will be addressed in the proper committee, which is public safety.
So, Madam Chair, if I could.
Yes, Representative Liebling.
So then, if it's going back to public safety then, and there is a fiscal note that impacts the Board of Public Defense, the courts, et cetera, is it your intention to bring it back here as well, or just let public safety handle those accounts?
That is to be determined, Representative Liebling. We'll see what, if any, fiscal note there is affecting any part of this committee.
So, Madam Chair, if I may.
Yes, Representative Liebling.
All right. I don't know if other members wanted to speak to the bill, to the, and I, you know, I'm aware that, of course, that warrants impact privacy. Of course, they do. And, of course, there's a lot of overlap between our jurisdiction and public safety. However, what we've been hearing today is a lot of testimony and discussion about just pure public safety aspects of this bill, and I don't think it's here for that purpose. But I would like to turn to some of the concerns that have been expressed. And I don't know, Madam Chair, are there other testifiers who wanted to testify to this bill?
Representative Liebling, yes. Mr. Martin is at the table, and I believe we have one other testifier. We have a couple of them. Amy Brallier and Evan Mulholland.
Okay, and so, Madam Chair, I guess what I would do is hold. Maybe I'll hold the rest of my comments and ask you to go ahead and let these people testify so that we, you know, don't use all our time on public safety and get some of the issues that are more pertinent to this committee. And then maybe that will, we may have questions for those testifiers as well.
Let's bring up Ms. Brallier. I hope I didn't botch that name too much. Welcome to the committee. When you get to the table, please state your name and go ahead with your testimony. I just want to say that I've been giving members on the Democrat side a lot of liberty to ask their questions, and that's primarily what we've been taking up here in this committee regarding this bill. So, and I still believe the questions that they were asking were tailored to the purview of this committee. Go ahead and state your name, please.
Good morning, committee members. My name is Amy Brallier. I'm a constituent of Paul's. Much of my work life, I was employed by the 4th Judicial District, which you may know is Hennepin County. I started out as a referees clerk and finished supervising 10 staff in a call center and retired after 17 years there. Today I will speak to Section 8, which is page 8, in House File 7 on critical infrastructure and vicarious liability. This bill states that not only may someone who is either arrested or convicted of trespass or causing damage is penalized, but that anyone associated with them, like other water protectors or agencies teaching them, becomes liable, even without a conviction, just upon an arrest. This could result in civil cases being filed because a contractor could claim an agency was at fault for the damages. This creates a broad and vaguely written criteria that could endanger innocent folk. As a Minnesotan who is privileged to have a family cabin in north central Minnesota, I believe I also bear responsibility to care for the water, land, and beings whose home this is. I speak against ideas that would penalize people for protecting these relatives. Having summered in Cass County for over 50 years, it was of interest and concern to me last week to listen to the Cass County Sheriff testify in support of this bill. His office was a member of the Northern Lights Task Force. This was a group of law enforcement leaders from the northern tier of counties crossed by Line 393. They used an Enbridge, a foreign oil corporation, funded escrow account to pay for riot gear, food, beverages, motels, wages, trainings, among other things. Cass County Sheriff's Office received over $900,000 from this fund. They were the third highest recipient of this fossil fuel company's money, with the first two being the DNR and the second, the Minnesota State Patrol. It benefited them to be policing, also known as harassing, following, and intimidating people who protect water. Our Minnesota leaders and laws are to protect the rights of all Minnesotans, not to forfeit them to corporations like oil and mining companies. Law enforcement must serve and protect the people, not corporate money. Targeting people who stand in the way of big business and who care for the forests and wetlands is not the way. Please vote against this overreaching bill.
Thank you, Mr. Brallier. Ms. Brallier. Evan Mulholland, I believe, is here. Mr. Mulholland, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and go ahead with your testimony.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Scott, members of the committee. My name is Evan Mulholland. I'm an attorney with the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, MCEA. MCEA is a nonprofit public interest law firm and advocacy organization with a 50-year history here in Minnesota defending our environment and the health of Minnesota's people. Thanks for the opportunity to testify today. So I'm here in opposition to certain sections of this bill. I have no opinion on all the stuff we were talking about earlier about tracking and the database and all that other stuff. I'm here to talk about the vicarious liability section in the because we're in the civil law committee. Vicarious liability is not necessary. In Minnesota, it's been against the law since 2002 to trespass on property containing critical public service facilities, utilities, and pipelines if those properties are posted. It's also already against the law to cause damage to the physical property of a critical public service facility, utility, or pipeline, again, since 2002. And like in most other states, Minnesota has a conspiracy law such that a conspiracy between two or more people to commit a crime is a crime itself, even if the underlying crime isn't even completed. So conspiracy is already against the law. That's MnStat 609.175. The targets of this bill, trespass, property damage, and the targets of this bill are trespass, property damage, and working with others to commit these crimes. This is already against the law. We don't need to extend vicarious liability to those who don't themselves damage the property. It's already a crime to conspire with someone to do that. We don't need these provisions in this law, so that's why we're opposed. The other reason is, you know, laws like this where you extend liability to people who didn't actually do the thing will have a chilling effect on protests and even talking about protests. And we want to encourage the people of this state to assemble, exercise their First Amendment rights, to speak out in public. We don't want to chill that, and we think that we at MCA think that this part of the bill could have that chilling effect. And finally, I just want to say we're in a worsening crisis. The continuing damage to our planet's intricate systems that support life on Earth, much of this damage to our climate, our health, and the continued existence of a lot of our non-human relatives is caused by the extraction, transport, and combustion of fossil fuels. Those people who call out these truths in the streets and on our public lands have my support and gratitude. Thanks for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there any further discussion on House File 7 as amended? Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How you doing, Rep. Novotny? Hello. Hey, I had a question. This goes around the database that you want developed from the county prosecutors in the courts. The question I had is, so when it is in this database where you're required to submit information around dismissals, what type of context will be provided there? And what I'm thinking about here is, say there's a situation where, and we've had this conversation before, there's a situation where an arrest is made, but law enforcement cannot provide the evidence necessary to charge that case. If you only list a dismissal, how is anyone publicly reviewing that supposed to have any context as to why the dismissal was actually given?
Chair Novotny.
Chair Scott, is there some way to adjust the volume up here that I'm getting quite a bit of echo from Representative Frazier?
I don't know if the pages can adjust the volume. I'm getting like some feedback too. I'm not completely hearing when folks are speaking into the mic from the table here. It's pretty difficult. Chair Novotny, do you want Representative Frazier to repeat his question?
If you could, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Is that better now? Can you hear me?
Go ahead.
Sounds like a no. The question was in regards to the database that your bill requires to be put in place. How are folks publicly viewing this going to have any context around dismissals? For example, if a case is dismissed because the investigators, law enforcement, could not provide the proper evidence for a prosecutor to make a determination that they could actually charge that case, how will that context be provided?
Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Scott. In the same way that Minneapolis Police Department has a very, I think, well-rounded, publicly searchable database that they have for crimes and things like that. So I think that would be the model that we were looking at when we were talking about this this bill and that particular provision. The, like I said, the Minneapolis dashboard for crime reporting is that there's nothing specific. There's nothing that will reveal any identity of any of the victims, make sure the data is protected that needs to be protected. So that's what we're looking at, and we want to see trends. We want to see which judges and which cases are going which way, so you can judge the bigger picture about what's going on. We talk about some of the, and not to circle back on Representative Liebling's concerns about public safety things, but after we had the testimony last Tuesday on this bill in public safety, was contacted by a mother of an individual whose son, the mother's son was killed a year ago by a person who was supposed to have received a mandatory minimum prison sentence. This person that killed her son was only able to kill her son because he didn't receive the mandatory minimum. That, according to the case that was presented and that he was previously convicted on, he didn't get that. That mother should be able to look up, and everyone else should be able to look up why that judge didn't give the mandatory minimum sentence. We had the presentation also in public safety that shows about half of all convictions result in the actual application of the mandatory minimum. 2 weeks ago, I thought it was just ironic, as I was preparing for this bill, there was a series of tweets on Crime Watch Minneapolis that were two separate cases that additional or subsequent murders had resulted in the arrest of people, and both of those cases that they presented from 2 weeks ago, or you know, that they reported from 2 weeks ago, were by individuals that had their previous convictions for crimes of violence with a firearm resulted, as it should have, in a mandatory minimum sentences. They wouldn't have been on the street to commit these new murders. I don't think we're doing the public any good, and I don't think we're doing the people that are committing these crimes any favors by not holding them to what the state has already decided at one point is something that we should do. At some point, there was a committee hearing just like this, and they said, we really think that crimes of violence involving a firearm are important, and that someone that is willing to take that step should be held accountable and should receive a fairly substantial penalty, that being the mandatory minimum. We fast forward to where we're at now, when mandatory apparently doesn't mean what it's supposed to mean. So the public needs to know that, and they should be able to look up what is going on, and they should be able to track what's going on and who's doing what without having to have someone that has a high degree of efficiency or access to records at the courthouse level.
Representative Frazier.
Representative Vodney. So that was my question was not about mandatory minimums or accountability. I believe in accountability. I always say accountability has its place. But my question was around, if you have this database and it merely lists out dismissals, where am I as a public individual reviewing this? And I'm a little bit more sophisticated because I'm familiar with the system and I've been a criminal defense attorney. The question is, how will you have the context of why a case was dismissed, or if there was a departure? Will that database also include evidentiary findings, conclusions from the judge, or would also include that if the prosecutor made a determination based on lack of evidence from the investigator or law enforcement that they could not bring that case and they had to dismiss it, will it include that information? And will it include the name and information of the investigator or law enforcement officer that was unable to provide the evidence to allow the prosecutors to charge that case?
Chair Novotny.
Chair. The language is pretty specific about what information is there. If you would like to add a provision for that additional information, I'd be willing to work with you on that. That would provide that clarification that you're looking for.
Chair Novotny or Representative Frazier?
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Mueller has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did have questions beyond just the tracking, so thank you for allowing me to speak again. And just one thing that was mentioned by Ramsey County Sheriff was the use of switches by juveniles, and we did make that a more substantial penalty in the last couple of years. So just wanted to mention that. I guess, you know, my one of my overall concerns with this bill is how much money it's going to cost. And I already do know that Public Defense Board is already saying that one portion of this, House File 340, is a separate bill that we'll be hearing in the Public Safety Committee. And we just got the fiscal note back on that. And the Board of Public Defense does have a cost. So I expect we'll see other costs both from them with some of the increased penalties here and potentially with the judiciary as well, given the increased penalties. So just wanted to make a point that I do expect it will involve the jurisdiction of this committee. On top of that, the amount of money that this could cost is really troubling in light of what we're facing right now with the Trump administration and cuts potentially to domestic violence shelters. I know there's a lot of laughter whenever I say this, but it's very serious. And some of those cuts are frozen, but some aren't. And we do know that domestic violence shelters, for example, are not able to access federal funding. Other potential cuts that have been proposed are really in the public safety sphere, so I won't list all of those now, but I just want to say that is an overarching concern I have with this bill and the funding that will come as a result of that. And so a lot of my other comments are related to public safety, so I'll just leave it at that, but just wanted to make that point. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Mueller, thank you. Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Novotny. To Representative Liebling's point earlier, there's multiple sections of this bill that deal directly with public data, judicial transparency, and prosecutorial clarity that we have jurisdiction of. So I do want to bring the focus back to that and to Representative Frazier's point earlier. Line 8.11 would allow for that reasoning to be clarified by a prosecutor if lack of evidence were to be a reason for a dismissal. But let's talk about that lack of judicial transparency and prosecutorial clarity that we have currently in the state of Minnesota. In 2024, our Sentencing Guidelines Commission data showed that there were a record 16,259 felony case sentences. There were only 11,519 in 2021. Judges departed downward on disposition 2,459 times, departed upward only 17 times. 28% of car thefts received downward durational departures and not one upward. This is all data that the public has a vested interest in knowing. They should be able to see how their judges, how their prosecutors are acting on their behalf, or if they are acting on their behalf. To that point, we had a record number of cases involving an offense with a firearm, and that was 1,805, but only 30% ended with a conviction and a mandatory minimum sentence. 48% were not charged, dismissed, or the mandatory minimum was waived altogether. So when it comes to that provision within the bill, I believe it's 5, 6, 3, and 21, the sections that would deal with that public data, this is a good thing to do for the state of Minnesota. This is a good thing to do for public safety. This is a good thing to do for public transparency and data that the public is capable of possessing. So wanted to bring that up, and thank you for your bill.
Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
I think Representative Frazier wanted to speak, and I'd like to go last, Madam Chair. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Ingen, thank you for sharing that. I appreciate it. Representative Vodney, I had one question. I want to bring this back to the data. It goes back to the database. We are aware that multiple offenders were pardoned for a January 6th involvement. My question, but this is a serious question, though, because we're also finding out that some of those folks that were pardoned have these child molestation claims that they are now dealing with.
Representative Frazier, what does this have to do with the bill before
us?
This
is about data. This is a question about his data bill. The question.
Okay, I'll allow you some grace here, but let's get to the point how this affects House File 7.
I need to lay it out. Thank you. I appreciate it. Madam Chair. Representative Novotny, would you be open to, or Representative Ingen, would you be open to adding language so that we could capture those particular individuals in our database so that we can track that?
As Chair Novotny.
If he's asking me if we can, is the question about federally charged cases, and could you clarify that for me?
Representative Frazier, could you clarify, please?
Yeah, the question is about the federally charged individuals that were pardoned on January 6th for assaulting officers and allowing individuals to be killed. But those individuals have some very egregious crimes that they're dealing with at the state level. My question is, would you allow for your bill to provide language to capture those individuals? Because we think that is important for the public to know that.
Representative Frazier, that is a big stretch for this committee. Chair Novotny.
Representative Frazier, if someone was involved in what happened on January 6th and they received a pardon and come into the state of Minnesota and commit child abuse, yes, I think we would want to know what's going on with that.
Thank you, Representative.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. I just have just a practical question on the information on, you know, if judges or prosecutors are, you know, a downward departure, staying, you know, all of this data, what do we do with it, right? So, like, collecting it to try to make sure there's transparency and accountability, how do you see that accountability and transparency sort of playing out once that data is collected and made available?
Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Scott. Representative Curran, it's information that will go to make better decisions about judges, their appointments, who's making the appointments, prosecutors, what's going on with prosecutors. This is the information age, and some people have information, have access to information. I think more people should be able to pull back the curtain and see what's going on in public safety and criminal justice. It's the main thing that the state's supposed to do. Article 1 of the Minnesota Constitution, Article 1, Bill of Rights, Section 1, object of government. The government is instituted for the security, benefit, and protection of the people in whom all political power is inherent, together with the right to alter, modify, and reform government whenever required by public good. The public can't make modification, they can't make a suggestion, they can't modify or reform government if they don't know what the primary objective, I would argue, of the state of Minnesota is to do, and that is public safety. Better informed public is a better informed public, and they can make better decisions about what's going on. If you've ever tried to talk someone through a bill, as I did with this mother of the son who was murdered, just trying to talk her through our website that we deal with every day, to how to find a bill, what is the result of the bill, what's going on, who's responsible for these decisions being made. So our hope is to get a publicly searchable database that is user-friendly. As I said, going back to what I've seen at Minneapolis's dashboard.
Representative Curran.
Thank you. I don't know that my question was answered, but I want to point out a couple of things. One, there are situations where judges don't have the discretion where they have to make a decision of a stay. And so for that to be reported, you know, we just want to make sure these things aren't being reported out of context, that there's information, you know, supporting decisions when they have to be made and not necessarily trying to create a database of judges that people just disagree with sort of thing. We want to make sure that the accountability goes all ways. And I also just want to make sure that we're protecting the private information of the people who are charged with making these decisions, which is why I, you know, wanted to protect judicial information from being doxxed last session. We all agreed that was a good idea. And so what I don't want is this to be used as a tool to sort of, like, attack judges or disseminate their personal information, that sort of thing. But I can certainly appreciate the effort for transparency.
Representative Mahmoud. Chair Novotny, if you have a response to that.
Yes, I would. It's good points, and keep in mind that we did put judicial protection in last year. And we're obviously aware that there are courts that have high dismissals rate, like the drug courts. And that's not, I don't feel that that's a slight on the drug courts, because that's what we want them to do. We want them to get people in a place where they can get their addiction taken care of. So, the rest of it is numbers or facts. Everyone understands that there's certain cases that have certain outcomes, but we're looking at trends. We're looking at habits. Do some judges make decisions more often than other judges or prosecutors? The only way we can do that is if we have the information.
Representative Mahmoud.
Thank you, Chair. Representative, I wanted to just understand your thoughts on posting information on who posts bail.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on how does that make our community safer?
Chair Novotny.
Interesting question. So this is a bill that's been around since, the riots of 2020. As it first came out, we found that there was a group called Minnesota Freedom Fund that is providing cash-free bail to people, many of which have committed violent crimes and repeated violent crimes. Wasn't anticipating that as a question that we had as part of this committee, but I've got a file buried from our boxes when we moved our offices last year, and tracked over 90 people just in the time that we bothered tracking it, of people that were either subsequently able to commit further crimes, many of them violent, or because they were bailed out, they were victims of retribution or reprisals for the crime that they were arrested for, if that makes sense. They were only out on the street because Minnesota Freedom Fund provided sometimes very large bails to them, including one that involved bailing out a person that was under arrest for murder. We've had multiple violent criminals that were arrested by Minnesota Freedom Fund. And this goes back to our original premise on people need to know. If your loved one was killed or was able to be in a position that they were not in custody, so they committed a violent crime that would result in them being in custody for a long time for a murder. Now they're able to commit a murder only because this group came in and provided money for, no questions asked. You should be able to know that. When I had this as a standalone bill, the only time I got any question or any traction or anybody wanted to know this was when there was a high-profile case with the high-profile person that was bailed out. Other than that, nobody cared. And it just shocked me at the one-sidedness. But yes, people should be able to know who's responsible.
Representative Mahmoud, a follow-up?
Well, I just think it's important that we are protecting families and not shaming individual families for wanting to help out their own family members. So I'll just leave it at that. But I do have another question. Within my district, you did mention Minneapolis about the carjacking rates. That's something I heard quite often at the doors. And you did mention that they are juveniles, the majority of them. So you wanted to apply these enhanced punishment towards them. But from the sheriff, we did hear that they wanted an opportunity to help the youth. And so I would just say that I hope that you would think of, you know, after school programs and youth programming that would benefit these youth and really focus on investing in them at a younger age. And just to say that, you know, victims want to see folks held accountable and punished. Speaking with my neighbors who have seen live jackings within their, just in front of their door, they don't want to see children punished. They want them to get help. So.
Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Representative Curran's point earlier on publicly available databases regarding these actions by prosecutors or judges, I think that that would be a tool that would allow the public to actually engage in a form of democracy. If residents in Hennepin and Ramsey aren't aware of the fact that in their counties there's a 50% chance that a criminal case would be departed or dismissed or state altogether, whereas the rest of the state is cumulatively 10.6%, then they can't engage in that grassroots activism that allows voters to mobilize and change the laws in which they live under. So that was a point that I wanted to bring up, but I appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Ingen. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Chair Navani. Sorry I had to step out. This job pulls us in many directions at once. I have two questions. The first, I wasn't able to ask some of these questions that I have in public safety, but I would love, I'm very concerned about the language that is intended to quell protest. It seems to be a very, very broad relationship to anyone involved in anything that has to do with any perhaps dissenting speech. And I know that's not what necessarily the purview of this committee, but I think it's very, very far-reaching and concerning that anyone involved in any of these things, open to the interpretation of anyone involved, could be convicted of a crime and put in jail for 10 years. To me, that's some dark state manipulation. But I'm not going to ask about that. I want to ask real quickly. I just want to, just to be safe, does this bill change? Does this bill protect, if you have a protest that's blocking a street, would this bill protect someone who drove their car into that protest?
Chair Novotny.
There's no language to that. The language that is in the bill that we talk about is protest on freeways, things like that. This doesn't address local streets.
Okay, I appreciate that. Sorry.
Go ahead.
I know that there have been legislative bills, introductions in the past to make it legal to drive into protesters, and we have seen that, and people have died because of that. So I just want to make sure we're doing that. I appreciate that. Second question is, there is a lot of – I'm not going to restate the questions that have been asked, but I would certainly like to hear the opinion of one of our county attorneys about how this database is going to affect their actual, like a searchable database of the kind that's being created here. Like, what does that do to, for example, County Attorney John Choi's office? I think that's something that I would love to hear about.
Oh, sorry, I turned my mic on, but you heard me anyway. Thank you. Mr. Choi, please come forward, state your name for the record, and if you heard that question, please answer it. If you didn't, let us know, and we'll have Representative Finke repeat it.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Finke, for the question and the opportunity to talk. And for the record, my name is John Choi. I serve as the Ramsey County Attorney. I'm also here today on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. And we have serious concerns about the provisions that are in Section 7 and I believe Section 6 and 7. And I know that there was an amendment that was done. I think the intent there was to try to alleviate the concerns that maybe some victim organizations have put forward. The reason, I mean, we're all for accountability. We're for transparency. In fact, my office has a dashboard. You can Google it. It's a Ramsey County Attorney data dashboard. We have a lot of the data related to our charging decisions, all of that stuff, and we report regularly to the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. And then also on our website, we have, like, research about all of the initiatives that we've been working on. Senator, Representative Feist talked about some of those things, but we're very transparent about that. And so I have a larger office, and we can devote some of our initiatives and our programming to be more just transparent. But I think the concern is, and we have gone through this, where when we built out the dashboard, we were very concerned about the fact that you throw out this data out there, and the way that the criminal justice conversation is happening in this country right now is that we have a lot of sharp edges and swords. And I think it's so important for prosecutors and the judiciary to try different things and to be able to achieve those outcomes. As an example, like this bill that's trying to get more reporting to the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, we've done this for decades. We have to report all of our mandatory minimum data since like the mid-80s. And for that whole time period, if you actually looked at like who was, and by the way, the justice system is not like a basketball game. Like who can get the most mandatory minimums, they win? Not at all. In fact, the largest county in our state, if you looked at historically that data, they probably imposed the mandatory minimum as a percentage the most. And I would say that in our largest county, we have some of the most serious gun violence problems. So these provisions that require prosecutors to report more things, I don't think necessarily leads to a better outcome. And then getting to the specifics of this bill, where we're talking about the reasons for the dismissal, it is so nuanced and complicated about trying to make sure that people understand all of the reasons for that. I mean, some of the reasons, I think, have been brought up by some of the victim organizations. Even if you took out the whether or not the victim supports or opposes the dismissal, there's still a provision that says we want the reason for it. And oftentimes it is because a victim isn't wanting to proceed. They're not wanting to testify. This is too traumatic. Sometimes it's the police that is asking us to dismiss the case because of other things. We don't want to put that into the public record. And there's other reasons, too, as well as, for instance, if there are constitutional issues with the case that were caused by the police. Again, I don't necessarily think that the public is necessarily served as a part of some sort of massive reporting. I think the best way to handle this is actually what we do in my community, where if there are questions that the police have, we answer them. We provide data on a regular basis to them. In fact, we meet every 2 months, and we go through data, police data, our data, judicial data, and we think about the things that we can actually work on together to improve. My concern and the concerns of my colleagues across the state would be that the amount of time and energy that would be focused on trying to explain all of these dismissals would not necessarily yield the type of information as well as the accountability that I think Representative Novotny is trying to get at. I think the better way is to have policies where prosecutors are open and willing to rethink a case. If a police chief in my jurisdiction says you got it wrong, we'll look at it again. If we have to and oftentimes decisions to dismiss a case, they're very nuanced, it's the hardest decisions that we have to make, and we shouldn't be doing that under political pressure. We have to act independently. We have to look at the facts. We have to look at the evidence. And the number one reason why a case will be dismissed is because there's insufficient evidence. As the case might have been charged, but then later down the road we find out that the victim is unavailable, a key witness is unavailable, or a number of things that are associated with the evidence. And I know that this committee does not want prosecutors in the state to be forging ahead on cases where they know that they cannot prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt, that that does not serve justice. And when you don't have justice, we're going to have other issues as well.
Thank you, Mr. Choi. Representative Devotny, did you have any comments? And then we're going to go to a vote in about 2 minutes.
Thank you, Chair. Can't thank County Attorney Choi enough for making those points. One of my favorite radio hosts has got a saying that everything he's invented has already been invented. So, as you know, this is a bill that's been around a while. I'd love to look at the information that you already have and that you're already providing in your dashboard. Mr. Choi also pointed out the reporting to sentencing guidelines that, as he said, it's already information that's supposed to go to sentencing guidelines. We just want a way to electronically transmit that and have that searchable too. That's, as he said, that's already information that's being provided. We just think it'd be a little more public. And when we originally started talking about this, as I said, they thought it would be easier to transmit this information to sentencing guidelines if we had this electronic dashboard set up.
Thank you, Chair Novotny. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So there are a number of things about this bill that I think are extremely troubling. One that was mentioned by a testifier is the critical infrastructure vicarious liability, which does say that a person who's arrested for a violation would now be liable, and a person who conspires with them, the vicarious part, if a person was arrested for a violation. I don't think that we, I may be wrong, but I don't think that we in this country punish people for being arrested. That is not something that we do. So that is a real problem. Another problem, and I could probably spend an hour going through this bill talking about the problems in it, but another one that is mentioned in a letter that's in our packets from Violence Free Minnesota talks about the searchable database to be maintained revealing who paid bail for detainees in domestic violence cases. It is not uncommon for victims of domestic violence to pay the bail for their own abuser. There are various reasons for this, such as an attempt to avoid retributory violence or due to the fact the abusive party is often the sole breadwinner. Forcing this information to be public does not protect survivors. Subjecting a victim survivor to additional scrutiny is an added danger in an already difficult and painful situation. So I think that's important to note before this committee as well. And then, you know, I do continue, even though it's not, I guess, specifically in our bailiwick here, but, you know, we're all concerned about public safety, and yet the biggest violation of public safety is occurring through the Trump administration, and the biggest violation, weaponizing of our criminal justice system, is occurring there. And that is what we need to be concerned about. And I certainly hope that doesn't come here, and I do worry that when we start making prosecutors give all this information, that we are making it easier to go in that direction. So, Madam Chair, I know you want to move on. I would ask for a roll call on the bill.
A roll call has been requested, and we will have a roll call. Chair Novotny, final words.
Ed, final. Thank you, Chair Scott. I think it's very clear cut on where our positions are. My willingness to work with concerned parties that have been involved here. This is a bill that is, you know, it's being changed and modified to reflect concerns, and as I've said before, and I will continue to work with concerned groups that are part of this. It's a good bill, and it reflects the request of many people and many situations that we feel can make Minnesota safer. Ask for a green vote.
Thank you, Chair Novotny. I renew my motion that House File 7 as amended be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Policy. The CLA will take the roll.
Chair Scott?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hudson?
Aye.
Representative Bliss?
Aye.
Representative Corinne?
No.
Representative Duran?
Aye.
Representative Ingen?
Aye.
Representative Feist?
No.
Representative Finke?
No.
Representative Fraser?
No.
Representative Mahmoud?
No.
Representative Mueller?
No.
Representative Rarick?
Aye.
Representative Steer?
The vote being 7 ayes to 6 nays, House File 7 as amended is on its way to public safety. Thank you for a good discussion on that bill. Next, we will invite to the table the Cannabis Expungement Board. So Mr. Rowader and Mark Haas. Welcome to the committee. It looks like our IT is working on all cylinders. I'm very thankful for that. We've had issues recently, so please introduce yourself for the tape and go ahead with your presentation. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Chair Scott. My name is Jim Rowder. I'm the Executive Director of the Cannabis Expungement Board. And
good morning, Chair Scott and members. My name is Mark Hazzi. I'm the Deputy Director and General Counsel for the Cannabis Expungement Board.
Chair Scott, just want to say thank you for inviting us to speak to the committee today and talk to you a little bit about our agency. If you go to the next slide, we're just going to cover briefly today an overview of what we do, a little bit of information about our implementation, a little bit of information also about our budget, and then Mr. Hasse will focus on doing a little bit more description on the statute and how we're building a process to review cases that may be eligible for expungement consideration. So the purpose, the Cannabis Expungement Board was created by the Adult Use Cannabis Act of 2023, as probably most of you know. The Bureau of Criminal Apprehension has identified at least 98,000 cases for potential review for eligibility. And the board's purpose is essentially to review records to determine if a felony case is eligible for expungement or resentencing. And the statute dictates that the Cannabis Expungement Board will operate until all records have been reviewed and the board has determined that its work is complete. If you're wondering what the Cannabis Expungement Board is actually comprised of, we have up here, it's 5 members, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, or her designee, and in this case, she has designated just recently retired Chief Judge Susan Siegel of the Court of Appeals, Minnesota Attorney General, or his designee, and he has appointed an Assistant Attorney General on his team, Ayodele Famadu, the Commissioner of Corrections, or his designee, and he has appointed Deputy Commissioner Safia Khan. There's one public defender, and that woman is Amanda Broadhag, who is a member of the Hennepin County Public Defender's Office. And there's one member of the public with particularly the statute requests that that public member have some victims' rights advocacy experience. That woman is Rebecca St. George. Among other things, she's the former Duluth City Attorney. Not too long ago. Little timeline on our progress. I started in this role last year, April of 2024, and we had our first board meeting in May of 2024. The statute requires that the board meet monthly. Also requires that the board meet in an open meeting session anytime it's considering cases for potential expungement or resentencing. We spent the summer, June through October evaluating case management systems, also identifying and working to address numerous technology issues and challenges with regard to how we can manage the data. Again, I'm reminding you all about the 98,000 minimum cases that the BCA has identified for review by the board. So that it has been a little bit challenging to get to work with Minnesota IT to come up with some effective strategies about how we can actually manage that data before we can even get to the point of managing the actual cases that we're going to bring to the board for review. By November of 2024, we had the key leadership staff on board, and in December, we had some of the first cases presented to the board for consideration for expungement. February of this year, after several months of vetting potential vendors for our case management system, we selected a vendor, worked with Minute to ultimately contract with them, and now we have an implementation schedule that should take us between now and the end of June of 25 to completely implement the case management system. And ultimately, our organization, as we continue to hire out our staff, mostly made up of staff attorneys and staff paralegals for the case review, should total about 35. With regard to our budget, you can see here it's pretty straightforward. The first year, we're at about $5.8 million, and that was about $300,000 over what our following year, 2025, budget was at 5.5, and that was just primarily to cover startup costs related to technology issues, case management system procurement, office space setup, and other operational needs like that. And as you can see going forward into the next biennium, we're essentially looking to be flat to 2025 with our budget. And now I'm going to hand it over to Mark Hasse, our Deputy Director and General Counsel, for a little bit more about the statute and our process.
Go ahead, Mr. Haas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just give a quick overview of the statute so that you all are recall or understand how it works, the core components. The statute lists essentially all of the recent cannabis convictions that exist that are making them eligible. It also requires that any case that's expunged does not involve a dangerous weapon or violent acts or threats. And it also requires that the act on which the charge was based would, under current law, not be a felony. It would be not a crime or under a felony. So that significantly limits the number of cases that would be eligible. Oops. A second part of the statute goes through a detailed review and determination process that the board has to undergo. There's a presumption that it's in the public interest, but that is one of the questions, and there's an eight-part analysis for that I think I have on the next slide. The board has to ask if the conviction should not only be expunged but also vacated and dismissed, if a person's gun rights should be restored, if the records for that conviction should be sealed at the Professional Educator Licensing and Standards Board, and if expungement's not in the public interest, should it be resentenced. The eight-part analysis I mentioned here, you can see is quite detailed. Nature and severity, risk to others or society, danger of release from sentence, aggravating or mitigating factors, statements from victims or law enforcement, whether there's good cause to restore the right to possess firearms and seal educational records, licensing records, any other factors deemed relevant. You might be wondering, I think we all have, as we've come to this work, how the board will apply this very detailed analysis to 98,000 records. We have developed a plan to at least get started on that. It's a phased-in approach, meaning the first phase is going to be to look at convictions for the lowest severity offenses, fifth-degree cannabis possession. And staff, you know, will look at the criminal complaint, determined that the amount of drugs possessed in the complaint qualifies for what would be currently a misdemeanor or less under current law. Verified that there's no mention at all in the complaint of violence or violent threats or weapons involvement. And then, you know, move to having the board act on those in bulk. They would still be able to quality control, check cases, go to the complaints, but staff will do a bulk of the work reviewing those initially. And then as we look at more serious cases, higher amounts of possession and some of the low-level sales that would be eligible, we would provide the board with the ability to look at those more closely and carefully. And then just quickly, we are asking for the legislature to make a couple of technical changes to the legislation or to our statute this year. Representative Hollins has introduced it in the House, and it would address the oversight of some longer past cannabis crimes that are not covered by the statute, and it would address an issue where the courts are not sealing the records in some multi-count cases. And that is the end of our presentation. Thank you, and we'll stay for questions.
Well, thank you very much. We'll go to member questions first. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you both for being here and for your work and your testimony. I am curious. You said 98,000 eligible cases under the criteria that have been laid out in the statute. That's correct? Yeah. 98,000. Yeah, sort of rhetorical. I know we said it a couple times.
Madam Chair, Representative Finke, just to be clear, those are that would be probably the entire universe. So it's anything that the conviction qualifies as a statute, and then as we look at them, that number will go down. For example, on fifth-degree possession, a number of those are going to include other drugs, so those would not be eligible because of the way the statute's written. So we have to look to see if cannabis was even the only substance that the conviction occurred for.
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that clarification. I think that the expungement work that we did for this in the last biennium is some of the one of the most important pieces of legislation that we passed. I am excited for this work to actually begin. This is life-changing work for some of the people who are going to have these cases expunged. And do you know when that might start actually happening for people in the community?
Mr. Rawater or Hazi? Say it again, please.
Rawater. A is kind of silent.
Okay. Go ahead with your answer.
I've had that all my life. I'm used to it. Chair Scott, Representative Finke, we did address some cases of incarcerated individuals in our December board meeting. And those were actually, some of those were more complicated than others, and decisions were made by the board. But as I think Mark Hasse has pointed out earlier in the presentation, we are now ready to embark, starting with our March board meeting, of addressing these fifth-degree possession cases, which there are a lot of. I'm sorry, how many? We have an estimate, roughly.
Actually, we don't have an exact estimate for that. It's not so easy to go through the
thousands.
Yes,
thousands. There's thousands of these fifth-degree possession cases. We're going to be start to bring those forward, for lack of a better term, in bulk. And we anticipate probably 40 of those cases being brought to the board in March for review, as well as then some complicated cases, which will certainly require more deliberation from the board members.
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm glad to hear that. I think that this work is urgent. I hope that all sides of the aisle can show the same urgency when we are correcting the abuses of the criminal justice system that we show when we are trying to foster people into it. So thank you very much.
I have a couple of questions. There's 98,000 cases to go through. That's a lot of cases. And so you're doing 40. You say in your presentation that you expect to be able to do about 100 cases a month going forward. Do you expect the velocity of that to kind of pick up as you kind of you get used to looking at these cases and seeing what the aggravating factors are and and all that stuff. Do you expect the 100 a month to kind of speed up as you get going?
Sure, Scott, that's an excellent question. I think the general answer to that question is yes, not only for the reasons you stated, but also as we get fully staffed and we refine and really get laser focused on how the process can identify the things that are necessary. 98,000 is a large number. One of the important parts of the work of the staff will be actually determining which of those cases aren't eligible and won't be brought forth to the board for consideration. So the combination of, I think, both those will certainly allow us to continue to just bring forward more cases in larger bulk sizes.
Can I just add a little detail to that?
Sure, go ahead, Mr. Hossie.
So currently we have on board two managing attorneys and two supervising paralegals. By roughly the middle of this year, we hope to have that built out to many more staff attorneys and paralegals. Based on the review we've done so far, we think we can do about 100 cases a month with just the staff we have. And so as we multiply the numbers of staff, those should go up into the hundreds, assuming this process works smoothly, which it seems like it will.
Okay. And do either of you have an idea of how many of these 98,000 cases are cases of people that are currently incarcerated?
Chair Scott, thank you for that question. I would say that by the time we got to the December board meeting and we addressed some of the first cases of people that were currently incarcerated, I believe at that time we had worked with the Department of Corrections to identify 29 cases. So quite actually a relatively low number of people that were actually currently incarcerated on a cannabis-related felony, or
okay.
At least involved a cannabis-related felony. Some of those cases involve other counts unrelated to
right.
a cannabis felony.
Very, very few were there just for cannabis.
What was that?
Very few were there just for cannabis.
Right, right. I'm sure there's
some. We are looking closely at those cases to, if there is relief for them, that they would be some of the first to get it.
Right. I'm sure there are a lot of factors, obviously, to be taken into account on these cases. So I did just, you know, some little math here. And if you do 100 cases a month, you're going to work yourself out of a job in 8 years. So after that, you know, all the cases should have hopefully been accounted for and all that. Any other member questions? I appreciate you being here today, and I look forward to more updates as we go along. If you've hit some milestones or whatever, please be sure and let the committee know. We're very interested in those milestones, just to kind of get a progress report every once in a while on what's going on. I don't know, in statute, Mr. Johnson, maybe you know, are there any reporting requirements that goes along with this board as far as giving updates to their work?
Go ahead.
Mr. Johnson.
We'll go ahead.
Oh, okay. We'll ask the testifier then if he
knows.
Yes,
we actually have an annual reporting requirement.
Okay.
And so we did file a report with the relevant committees. The filing date is by January 15th of each year. We didn't have a lot of case data to report, so the report was largely some of the information that we've discussed here today in terms of the purpose of the board, the makeup, a little bit about process. But we didn't have – going forward, the report will – have a lot of detailed information about the outcome of decision making by the board on cases with a lot of different data points broken down.
Perfect. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank
if you. There are no other member questions, with that, we are adjourned.